Hello. In 1754, an ambitious but inexperienced 23-year-old lieutenant colonel in the Virginia militia was sent with a small contingent of soldiers by his British superiors to a disputed area of western Pennsylvania. There, he was to locate a larger group of French troops who were in the process of building a fort and order them to depart from what the British considered to be their territory. When his demands were completely ignored by the French, the overeager officer attempted a clumsy sneak attack, which failed miserably, and he was then forced to withdraw. This little incident would be relatively insignificant, but for two facts. First of all, the young lieutenant colonel's name was George Washington. And from that rather inauspicious beginning, he would go on to a far more glorious military career. And second, the episode set into motion a chain of events that ultimately would help spark a global war between England and France. By the mid-1700s, the American colonies ruled by England were firmly entrenched along the Atlantic seaboard. And they had by this time a population of about 1.5 million inhabitants. However, the future expansion of the colonies was greatly hampered by the fact that the land west of the Appalachian mountain chain was considered to be French territory. For a while, geography and differing goals maintained a degree of separation between the two sides. The English, along the eastern seaboard, focused on farming and on building up European-style colonies. By contrast, the French took a very different approach. They concentrated on the fur trade and on acquiring pelts through trapping and trading with the indigenous peoples. Although the French in North America numbered probably no more than 70,000, they lay claim to a vast diagonal band of territory called New France, which stretched from the St. Lawrence Waterway through the Great Lakes down all the way to the city of New Orleans. Daring voyageurs, alone or in little groups, ventured out from the cities of Quebec and Montreal, traveling westward through the Great Lakes and then exploring southward along the mighty waterways of the Midwest, such as the Mississippi and Ohio rivers. Along those, they established a series of trading posts and forts. And this whole tenuous network of far-flung French outposts effectively blocked any possible westward movement by the English. And so conflict between the two sides was inevitable. After a series of escalating border incidents, in 1756, what would become known as the Seven Years' War broke out between France and England. Among the main British objectives of this war was to seize control of the strategic St. Lawrence Waterway. Situated on a series of high bluffs overlooking this river was the capital of New France itself, the fortress city of Quebec. If Quebec could be taken, then the main route of communication and trade that linked all of New France would be severed, and the British could then lay claim to North America. The commanders at the Battle of Quebec, the Frenchman Montcalm and his English counterpart Wolfe, have elicited very different reactions from subsequent French, British, Canadian, and American historians. Wolfe, in particular, continues to be a polarizing figure, so much so that he's portrayed in some biographies as being one of the great military geniuses of all history, whereas in others, he's depicted as a borderline incompetent. As testimony to the contemporary political passions which his memory can still provoke today, a monument to him on the site of the battle is regularly defaced by ardent French Canadians. What all seem to agree upon concerning Wolfe, though, are his extreme devotion to his chosen profession, his driving ambition, and his rather unfortunate, unattractive physical appearance. He was also in a consistently wretched state of health. Wolfe was from a military family. His father, his grandfather, and great-grandfather were all notable soldiers. And so, perhaps not surprisingly, from a young age, he dreamed of achieving distinction within the British Army. He was a shameless self-promoter. He would trumpet his own achievements on the battlefield, and he constantly lobbied and pulled strings in order to get appointments that he desired. But he was also courageous. He led his men from the front, and he dedicated himself to mastering his profession with an unusual degree of single-mindedness. This led him to spurn the kinds of idle socializing that most of his fellow officers tended to engage in. By virtue of both his abilities and his aggressive self-promotion, he ascended through the officers' ranks of the British Army with unusual rapidity, so that by the time he gained command of the attack on Quebec as a major general, he was only 32 years old. He was described as being a tall, gangly man with a dramatically receded chin that contrasted ill with a large, outthrust triangular nose, and he had an unruly shock of red hair on his head. He struggled with ill health all throughout his life, and at the time of the campaign against Quebec, he was racked by fever and suffering debilitating bouts of pain from kidney stones. If Wolfe's pushiness and arrogance sometimes offended his fellow officers, his attention to duty and bravery seemed to have won him the regard of the common soldiers. For example, when it was known that Wolfe would be leading the Quebec campaign, the reputation that he had earlier gained inspired the composition of a song which was popular during the campaign called Hot Stuff, and among its lyrics were, "Come, each death-doing dog who ventures his neck, come, follow the hero that goes to Quebec, and ye that love fighting will soon have enough. Wolfe commands us, my boys, we shall give them hot stuff." Wolfe's opponent at Quebec was the Marquis de Montcalm, a French nobleman who was also descended from a long line of military officers. Like Wolfe, he was an experienced soldier who was demonstrably brave on the battlefield. But Montcalm affected an aristocrat's stereotypically unruffled demeanor in the face of any danger. For example, when he was just a young man serving in Italy, he wrote a letter home to his mother in which he described his behavior in combat with deliberate understatement. He wrote, "Yesterday we had a vexatious experience. A number of officers, generals, and colonels were killed or wounded. I am among the latter with 5 saber cuts. Fortunately, none of them are dangerous, notwithstanding that I lost a great deal of blood." While possessing a charm and sophistication that Wolfe lacked, Montcalm could be somewhat touchy, and he had some of the era's prejudice against anyone he regarded as a social inferior. And so, when he was assigned to command in North America, he was not afraid to openly express his disdain for both the Indians, who were allies of the French, and for the local French Canadians. He viewed himself as a man of principle and a defender of civilization and honor who had been cast into a brutal wilderness. This led to conflict with the Canadian-born Governor General of New France, who both had an especially thorny personal relationship with Montcalm and disagreed radically with him over how the war should be fought. The Governor General advocated a kind of guerrilla warfare using Indians and local soldiers. This was something that Montcalm found morally troubling. Montcalm believed that ultimate victory could only come from the employment of regular French troops fighting a conventional European-style set-piece battle. Tensions grew to the point where the two men refused to talk to one another and communicated mostly through chilly letters. Quebec is situated on a high, rocky promontory projecting out on the north side of the St. Lawrence waterway. It's protected to the east and the south by the St. Lawrence, and to the north by the Charles River. The walled upper city stood high above the river on a plateau. The smaller lower city was down by the river. Up on the plateau to the west of the city was a stretch of flat farmland known as the Plains of Abraham. This was named after the man who had first settled there, Abraham Martin. Along the edges of this plateau were a line of steep cliffs, which dropped about 200 feet down to the St. Lawrence. The French believed that the cannons of Quebec could prevent British ships from proceeding further up the St. Lawrence River. To prevent British troops being landed further down the St. Lawrence and marching up to Quebec, Montcalm had an elaborate series of fortifications and strong points constructed for several miles along the northern escarpment. This line of outposts culminated near a 300-foot cliff over which the Montmorency Falls plummeted. Montcalm nevertheless judged that this zone of the St. Lawrence was the most likely area for an attempted British landing, and so he stationed the majority of his field army here. To capture this stronghold, Wolfe was assigned a relatively small army of about 8,500 men. But what it might have lacked in numbers, his force made up for in quality. It included 10 excellent battalions of British regular line infantry, and they were supported by some grenadiers, a contingent of artillerymen from the Royal Regiment of Artillery, and 6 companies of American Rangers. Wolfe's main subordinates were all young, eager, and competent. He also enjoyed the support of the sizable fleet of Royal Navy warships and crews that had transported his army to its target. And this fleet offered an important resource in terms of spare cannons, gunpowder, supplies, manpower, boats, and experience with amphibious landings. On the other side, Montcalm had scraped together maybe 13,000 to 15,000 troops of all kinds. A substantial portion of these could not be considered truly dependable, either due to their questionable loyalty, as in the case of a contingent of 2,000 allied Indians, or because of their dubious quality, such as the roughly 2,000 men of the city garrison. Another 3,000 to 4,000 of Montcalm's army were composed of militia, who were drawn from French-Canadian trappers and traders. And with their woodland skills, this group could be very useful as skirmishers. But they also were a bit undisciplined. A large number of sailors were pressed into contributing to the defense of the city, and even 35 Jesuits from the city's seminary were conscripted. The core of Montcalm's forces, and the group in which he clearly had the most faith, was his 8 battalions of regular French infantry, although these were very much under strength and altogether probably totaled no more than 5,000 men. The British arrived in the region of Quebec in June of 1759. They landed on a large island in the St. Lawrence that was about 4 miles below Quebec. After establishing an artillery battery on the southern shore, directly opposite Quebec, Wolfe probed a number of points along the French defenses, and he came up with and then canceled several plans of attack. Finally, he determined to launch an assault at the far end of the French fortified line on the northern bank near the Montmorency Falls. The chosen day for the attack was July 31st, but the boatloads of soldiers experienced substantial delays, and so they didn't eventually land until late in the afternoon of that day. The British grenadiers enthusiastically leapt from their boats into water that was at times chest deep, and they managed to capture one French redoubt, but they couldn't force their way through the main French lines. Another arm of the attack that was supposed to come along the shore bogged down, and so the whole assault was then just called off. In addition to failing to achieve its objectives, the poorly executed attempt cost Wolfe over 400 Prime soldiers killed and wounded. Meanwhile, however, the British had discovered that they could run ships upriver past the guns of Quebec, and this discovery opened up new possibilities for where to crack through the city's defenses. Wolfe had also already begun a two-pronged strategy, which was designed to wear down the defenders' will to resist. This consisted of a combination of direct bombardment of the city and a campaign of laying waste to the surrounding countryside. Employing heavy cannon and mortars, some of which were supplied by the Navy, Wolfe pounded Quebec without mercy. The shelling sparked destructive fires, and whole sections of Quebec were effectively flattened. Out in the countryside, an estimated 1,400 farms were burned, and so the region around Quebec was transformed into a smoking wasteland. Wolfe described the stalemate in a letter to his mother. He said, "My antagonist has wisely shut himself up in an inaccessible entrenchment, so that I can't get at him without spilling a torrent of blood." Meanwhile, Wolfe's health had deteriorated to such a degree that he was a wreck both physically and mentally. He was so weak he was barely able to get out of bed. When he collapsed on September 4th, rumors that he was dying flew through the camp, and only heavy doses of opiates enabled him to function. Just urinating caused him debilitating pain. His doctor repeatedly bled him, which, of course, weakened him yet further. Wolfe believed himself to be at death's door, and fear that failure would taint his memory, he was spurred to embark on another major attack. However, he was reluctant to share his plans with anybody, and he also kept changing his mind, so that what he intended and where he would attack remained a mystery even to his peers. Finally, Wolfe chose a date and a place for the next attempt. This would be a more direct assault aimed at the cliffs that line the plateau just west of the city. Montcalm had established a series of pickets to keep watch along these cliffs, but most people believed they were too steep to offer any reasonable route of attack for an army. Wolfe had noted one spot, known as the Anse au Foulon, where a steep trail ran from the water to the top of the cliffs. The trail was blocked by a barrier, and there was also a strong guard post at the top, and a nearby battery covered the landing site at the base of the trail. But Wolfe nevertheless decided that this spot constituted a weak point in the defenses. He determined upon a nighttime landing from boats that would seize control of this trail. The appointed date was the night of September 12th to 13th. The plan was for the assault force to start upriver and then drift down silently on the current. Hopefully, they would land at the base of the trail, slaughter the guards, fight their way to the top, and then overwhelm the guard post there. The main army could then follow and strike at Quebec from the land side. There were a couple other diversionary attacks that would be made the same night. Everything depended on speed and the vigilance of the defenders. If they were not overcome quickly, a small group could probably hold that steep, narrow trail and deny the attack access to the plateau. This would strand the majority of the British at the water's edge, where they would be vulnerable to fire from the nearby battery. Whether or not this plan should have succeeded is debatable, but the British now enjoyed an extraordinary string of lucky breaks that allowed the attack force to seize control of this vital trail. First of all, Montcalm had stationed a French officer with a powerful flying column of elite troops opposite from the British ships where the attack would emanate. This officer was supposed to keep a close watch on the ships, and if he saw any boats being launched from them, he was to move to intercept and destroy that landing force. On the critical night, however, he completely failed to notice the heavily laden boats departing from the ships and gliding downstream on the current. Next, the officer in charge of the detachment guarding the trail at the Anse au Foulon, a guy named Captain Vergor, he had been told to expect a convoy of French boats that very night bringing supplies to the city. Now, as it turns out, that convoy had been canceled. But nobody bothered to pass along this essential information to Vergor and his men. So, when the British boats materialized out of the darkness at the Anse au Foulon, the French sentries took them for the supply convoy. And this impression was further strengthened when the sentries shouted out a challenge to the boats, and a quick-thinking, French-speaking British officer answered them. This officer even had the audacity to berate the sentry, demanding that the Frenchman keep his voice down, lest he alert the British. Another incident in this fortunate chain of events, at least from a British perspective, occurred when another French captain, who was in charge of one of the pickets posted along the cliffside, was not able to complete his usual nocturnal patrol, because one of his horses had just been stolen and the other two had gone lame. Next, some of the English boats were carried on a strongly ebbing tide, and they overshot the landing zone by a couple hundred meters and eventually came ashore at the base of the cliffs where there was no apparent route upwards. Some of this group ran back upstream along the shore looking for the trail. But the light company, which was under the command of an enterprising officer named Colonel Howe, instead threw themselves at the cliff face and scrambled directly upward. The face of the cliff was composed of slippery shale stones, but the soldiers hauled themselves up it, pulling on trees and bushes that protruded from the rocks. Montcalm had earlier mockingly dismissed the possibility of any troops being able to scale this cliff, stating, "It is not to be supposed that the enemies have wings so that they can in the same night cross the river, disembark, and climb the obstructed acclivity." Howe's men proved those words false. Coming from this totally unexpected direction, they took the sentries guarding the top of the trail totally by surprise. They sowed further confusion in the French ranks when the same French-speaking officer now shouted out that they were a group sent to take the sentries' places, causing some of the French sentries to actually just leave the scene. Thus, the boats overshooting the landing site, which initially seemed like a disaster, was transformed into a brilliant success. Attacked on two sides by Howe's men coming along the clifftop and by other British troops storming up the trail, Captain Vergor's men were overwhelmed or fled. Wolfe and the rest of the British army were now able to land, climb up the trail, and even haul along a few small cannon with them. The first light of dawn found them assembling on the Plains of Abraham in front of the city of Quebec. One of Vergor's men supposedly managed to escape and run all the way to the city, where he brought word of the successful English landing. He reached one of Montcalm's aides with his story, but the aide was so complacently certain that this section of the defenses was unassailable that he decided the messenger was insane. So he just sent him away and went back to bed. Soon enough, Montcalm discovered Wolfe and the British army of around 3,000 men drawn up in a line of battle facing the city. The first ones to respond to this threat were about 1,500 French-Canadian militia, who infiltrated through the woods on either side of the plains and opened up a harassing fire on the British troops. Their fire was actually so effective that Wolfe ordered his men to lie down so that they would present a more difficult target. Meanwhile, Montcalm was mustering his available battalions of professional French line infantry, and he sallied forth from the city and deployed them in a line facing the British. They seemingly numbered a bit over 2,000 men, and Montcalm has often been criticized for not having waited for an extra couple of hours until reinforcements could arrive from the large detachments that he had posted both up and downstream from Quebec. He's also sometimes been criticized for coming out in the first place from the city to face Wolfe in a head-on infantry battle rather than simply holding out behind the very solid walls of the city. Maybe he felt that the British had to be opposed immediately before they could get firmly established on the plateau, and that this, striking quickly, was his best chance. In any event, the stage was now set for a classic battle of one line of infantry versus another. Neither side had any cavalry, and there were only a couple light cannon present. So this would be a true open field test of the determination and the firepower of one side against the other. At about 10 a.m., Montcalm ordered his line forward into the attack. The French chose to open fire at a relatively long range, and following their usual doctrine at this time, each individual soldier shot and then reloaded as fast as they were able. The British, by contrast, held back until the French had closed to within 40 to 60 yards away, and then they fired in groups by platoons. The battalions at the very center of the British line held their fire even longer, and then they unleashed a single, more coordinated volley. Wolfe had ordered his men to load their muskets with an extra ball, and observers recorded that the effect of this one volley was devastating to the French ranks. In just a couple minutes, it was all over. The French broke and fled, streaming away towards the northeast, towards a bridge that they hoped would offer refuge. The British chased them, but their lead elements were then ambushed by the French Canadians who were still lurking in the woods. Overall, the British suffered 658 killed and wounded, and many of those casualties were actually inflicted here at the very end of the battle. The French lost roughly the same number. The two most famous casualties of the battle were Wolfe and Montcalm. Wolfe had been struck early on by a musket ball through the hand, but he just wrapped it up and kept going. Then, at the height of the battle, he was hit in the chest by a ball that penetrated his lungs, and he was dead within a few minutes. According to legend, though, he'd lived long enough to hear that he had been victorious, and supposedly he expired saying, "God be praised, now I will die in peace." Montcalm seems to have been fatally wounded just a few minutes later, during the retreat, most probably by a grapeshot fired from one of the British cannon. He managed to ride back to Quebec, and he died the next morning. The city surrendered 5 days later on September 18th. Although the mopping up of French forces in North America would take another year, the fall of Quebec was the decisive moment. And it was a moment that shifted the entire history of North America from one in which the region potentially would develop as a French-speaking zone in which French culture was dominant, into one in which the English language and British culture would prevail. Perhaps the most profound effects of the battle were that it directly contributed to the birth and development of the United States. And this is because one immediate effect of the war was that to cover its cost, the British crown levied new, heavier taxes on the American colonies. And this, of course, would be an imposition that would be a source of considerable resentment among the colonists and would become one of the principal causes of the American Revolution. On the French side, the war weakened the monarchy and drained the treasury, provoking harsh new taxes. All of that contributed directly to the upheaval of the French Revolution, which took place shortly thereafter. In the long term, the removal of French power along the Mississippi River and other areas in the Midwest allowed the newly independent American colonies to finally be able to expand westward past the Appalachians, and they would go on to claim the rest of what would become the continental United States. Thank you.